everyone. Chat Cemetery is back, as is Katie Schaefer. Today we're talking about Needful Things, which is a book that contains a ton of characters, certainly an ensemble cast, somewhat like It, but maybe even more characters than It. It's a little hard to tell, but I think there's a ton to discuss here. But Katie, I first want to start with whether or not this was your first time reading this book, because it was for me and I had no idea what to expect.
I think I had read part of it. I remember up to a certain point, and then everything else that happened, I was like, did I read this? I don't remember this happening. I remember the beginning of it really well. So that's my guess. And if I did, I think I was maybe 16, pretty young. So it was quite a while ago that I read it.
Yeah, when I looked at the cover that I have, it was like, you know, the last Castle Rock story. And I was like, well, it's not. But now I'm very intrigued, because Castle Rock has appeared recently in King's novella Elevation. And it appeared, I think, somewhere else along the way, a short story that acts as an epilogue to this, which I'm kind of glad he didn't really have an epilogue in this. So it'll be interesting to see what the short story It Grows on You has in store, since I've heard that it is sort of an epilogue to this, and that is collected in Nightmares and Dreamscapes, which I believe is coming up somewhere on my list soon. But I just really like the character work that he did with this, and there's so much of it, because, you know, just for a quick rundown, in case anyone listening to this hasn't read it in a while, you have Alan Pangborn, who is the sheriff of Castle Rock, Leland Gaunt, who is the owner of the store Needful Things, Brian Rusk, Polly Chalmers, Norris Ridgewick, Ace Merrill makes an appearance, Danforth Buster Keaton, Wilma Jerzik, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Nettie Cobb, yep, Myrtle Keaton, Hugh Priest, Henry Beaumont, and Sally Radcliffe. Those are sort of the main characters that you get glimpses of. And I like how King didn't spend too much time on any one set of characters. He kind of bounced all around, and I feel like that gave you a better perspective of what everyone was doing at any given time. It's like, oh, hey, you know, Alan's over here doing this thing. Brian's over here doing this thing. And then you have Ace Merrill coming back into town. So you have all of these characters living their lives simultaneously. And he really captures that well by not just going in a straight line like, okay, here's what happened with Alan and Polly. Here's what happened with so-and-so and so-and-so.
Right. This is probably the best example I've seen from him so far, where he is able to keep a current timeline. You know, it's not like we need notes. And now what so-and-so is doing, well, this happened. You know, it's very obvious that, and it's not confusing as you're reading it to know, yes, that everything's all happening at once. And he doesn't even need to explain it for you to get that sensation. And it does a good job, but it isn't trying to do that necessarily. It very much bounces back and forth between timelines and ignores the idea that you need to have it all feel like it's happening at the same time, except at the very end. But in this, it just kind of flows really well. And there are a ridiculous amount of characters, and they become more and more as you get to the end of the book. And at a certain point, it's more about what's happening than the characters, as we get into, like, with the church people near the very end. Like, you don't right. really need to know who those people are. You just know you've heard their names before. And so at first I was really frustrated by it. And then I realized, like, oh no, these are just almost avatars to explain how the town is kind of imploding all at once, because you can't have your three or four main people everywhere. So here's a perspective to watch it unfold.
Yeah. And even a character like Reverend Rose, you're kind of like, okay, you know, we see what's going on here. He's upset about this casino night, and he just really doesn't want it to happen because of whatever moral reason he has. And then at the end, when you have all of the church people going up against each other, you're kind of like, okay, this is just an example of the chaos that is consuming Castle Rock right now. And that moment doesn't really have any inherent importance. it's just something that is a side effect of everything that's going on. And even though you have more characters than the ones that I listed, those characters are really the ones who drive the story forward. You have this rivalry between Wilma and Nettie for whatever reason. Wilma is probably crazier than Nettie, even though Nettie is the one who ended up being mentally unstable. And Wilma is just one of those people who she wants to get her way no matter what. And it doesn't matter if she has to lie to do it or terrify people to do it. She's just going to be a bully. And that's exactly how King portrays her. And it's done so well, because typically you think of bullies in the King universe and you think of someone like Ace Merrill instead. But Wilma might be an even bigger bully than Ace Merrill, admittedly.
I think it's like she gets off on the adrenaline and the cruelty and the fight. You know, it's portrayed in the book that, you know, she's constantly looking for someone to feud with for whatever reason. Doesn't have to really be a reason. It's just someone to challenge and win. You know, like you said, she's always got to win. And it just, you really get a sense of her drive and her need almost to do this, to just fight with people about nothing. And it's, like you said, she's such a villainous character, but someone who is so relatable. Like, we've all met those people who are just constantly looking to pick a fight over things that you just, you don't need to fight over, like a parking spot, you know? And she's... Yeah. And then her interaction with Nettie Cobb, who is just like a shrinking violet, this woman who has been beaten down and abused by her husband, who finally snapped and is trying to just live her life and feel okay every day. And so when the two of them come to a head, like, you know it's going to be bad because you know what Nettie is capable of. And their interaction feels so inevitable. Like, once you see how it starts, you know these two people, if it gets bad enough, it's going to be a real violent show. And then it is.
Exactly. And Wilma really has no purpose if she's not being the bully. We don't really know what she does. I think she works at a grocery store part-time or something. She doesn't really have any purpose other than being the town bully. But for Nettie, she's this slightly more complex character because she has been through so much. She killed her husband and then Polly went to bat for her and she's a housekeeper now. She has a dog that she really cares about, but Wilma just makes all this stuff up about the dog barking even when he's not. And you can really see everything boiling up and you just know all of a sudden it's going to overflow and get really crazy. And that's exactly what it does. So it's not necessarily that King even subverts any expectations. You know what to expect out of a lot of these characters. And there are still some surprising moments in this book. But I like when you can write a character so well that the audience knows exactly how characters are going to react to certain situations before you read their reactions to certain situations.
Right. And he does it. He also gives you so many different sides of a character like Nettie Cobb. We don't get as much of that with Wilma, but with Nettie in particular, the scene where Polly's hands, because Polly has arthritis and her hands really start hurting, where Nettie breaks out of this spell that she's been put in by Gaunt, and Nettie goes over there and she's just so kind and so loving and takes care of Polly in such a sincere way, and she's able to shed all of this insecurity and pain that she lives with and just be there for her friend. And that just makes her so much more dimensional than, you know, this victimized, abused woman who also has this spark of violence in her if she's pushed too far. You know, that's a flat character. But King rounds her out by showing the good sides of her and how she is so complex. And she, I think, is one of the characters I really enjoyed reading because of that complexity.
Yeah, and then you have characters like Alan and Polly, who really seem to be the grounded characters in this story. Even though Polly is suffering with her arthritis and Alan has a lot going on as sheriff, especially by the end of the novel, the two of them really feel like they're sort of like the parents, so to speak, of this story. Alan's kind of looking out for the whole town. Polly gossips a bit, but she still has this maternal care for Nettie in a way that I think a lot of people in the town might not necessarily understand. So you have these two characters who are really taking it upon themselves to not only care for each other, but to care for so many other people around them. And you can see when Alan goes and talks to Brian, he's not really being an authority figure. He's doing magic tricks, trying to sort of coax the information out of him without being threatening to Brian.
Right. Or when he's with Brian's brother later.
Yeah.
Who's like 7, I think. And he's just so affectionate and careful.
Mm-hmm.
So Alan really, and we've seen Alan in other books, as we'll talk about, but he is just such an interesting character that he's the one, of course, who drives the main story. We get most of the perspective of what's happening from Alan, and he is kind of the one figuring out what's going on here. And I'll say, in the beginning, I was like, how the hell is he going to figure this out? And it comes so naturally to him. Like, he's just able to pick these little things up and isn't afraid of believing the things that seem entirely impossible. To the average person, I don't think that what Alan deduces by the end would seem real. But he's able to just, well, this is what seems to be happening, so I'm going to go with it.
Yeah, a lot of that progression for Alan stems from his appearance in the Dark Half, because the Dark Half was such a wild scenario. You see him trying to wrap his head around it throughout that entire novel, and by the end of it, he's like, oh, this is really happening, and this is insane. How is this happening? And you even get callbacks to the sparrows in this, which I really liked, because then it kind of connects Alan's way of thinking with his previous appearance in The Dark Half. And have you watched Castle Rock on Hulu?
Only the first 2 episodes. And I'm, after reading this, I'm like, I really got to get back to that show.
Yeah. And so much of Alan's character in that show made a lot more sense after reading this. You just know that he has seen so many weird, unexpected, inexplicable things that his character in that makes a lot more sense because of the portrayal of him in The Dark Half and this. And I had not read either of these before watching that show. So I was like, okay, I know this guy is going to have some sort of significance in the King novels at some point because they focused on him so much in the show. And you even see things like the Mellow Tiger. And I was like, okay, it's a bar. I can tell it's a reference, but I don't really know what it's a reference to just yet. And I did catch a lot of the other references to like Cujo and things like that. But after reading Needful Things, you really just get this whole picture of what Castle Rock is like as a town and the people who live in it. Because you have another character in Ace Merrill who returns. He's been gone for a while. We remember him from the body for those of us who have read that story. And he has aged so much in that time. You know, he's definitely a lot older, and I believe he's even going gray is sort of how he's described. And you can tell he's had a rough life, but he comes back and he's still sort of the town bad boy and criminal.
Right. Everyone knows that they see him and it's, oh, there's trouble. This is a problem. And that I believe someone even lets Alan know, like, hey, this guy's back in town.
Yeah.
And you see Alan like, okay, how am I going to deal with this new addition to all of the problems that are happening around town? Because I think by the time he appears, you know, it's well after Nettie and Wilma's interaction, you know, so everything has really started to go crazy at that point. He's like, I don't have time for this. You need to leave.
Yeah, it's like Ace doesn't really appear until at least halfway through the book, I want to say.
Yeah, definitely.
I wasn't even expecting him to show up because I was like, oh, okay, we have Alan Pangborn. You know, we have these other characters. You have Leland Gaunt, who is the out-of-towner, and I do want to talk about him a little more specifically after we get through a few more of these characters because, you know, Ace has a big role towards the end, but Buster Keaton is really sort of the resident pain in the ass for Alan.
Oh, that scene in the beginning with the two of them like going back and forth. Oh, that was so good.
And he's the town's head selectman. I'm not 100% sure what that means, but obviously he is a city figure of some sort, and he has authority to sort of get away with not necessarily badgering people, but he just gets away with criminal acts like embezzlement and things like this because people are too afraid to go up against him. But Alan is not afraid of him. But Alan does know he has to play the politics game in order to get what he wants out of Buster Keaton. And he hates being called Buster. So
you have that
little tension throughout with this character, too. And you have so many characters who qualify as villains in this. And Keaton is definitely one of them. But none of them really seem to be able to top Leland Gaunt by the end of this. And I think that's what makes not only that character so interesting, but all of the rest of these villains, so to speak, that we see throughout. It's like, oh yeah, you all suck, but you don't hold a candle to Leland Gaunt.
Right. And I have to say, I love that King put the Buster Keaton because while I'm reading it, I haven't seen the film version of this yet, but all I could picture was the actor, Buster Keaton, who is renowned for being like such a nice person. He was so nice and he always plays like this really down on his luck guy. So this is a very, these two images in my head are not coming together. So, and I wonder if he did it on purpose because I'm sure Stephen King knows who Buster Keaton is.
Oh, absolutely.
But yeah, and I really enjoyed his addition of Buster Keaton because it really, you know, Alan is like the voice of authority for the town. And then he has to war with this other voice of authority that controls the budget and can push his weight around, so to speak, and make things hard for Alan, even though as an elected official, he can't fire Alan and there's certain stuff he just can't mess with. And so I love that in the beginning, it sets up this rivalry almost, or this conflict between the two of them where Alan is just like, oh, this guy. And Buster feels, as we come to learn about his paranoid delusions, that Alan is them. You know, he's against him, even though Alan is just like, I'm just trying to police this town. Could you just chill out? So it's such a good villain and could probably play a much bigger villainous role, except we get Leland Gaunt. So he doesn't hold a candle, like you said.
Yeah, and the thing about Leland Gaunt is that he comes across as this earnest guy who is just trying to accommodate people and give them the things that they would really enjoy in life. And you know it's kind of fishy because Castle Rock is one of those towns where you don't really get too many people moving there from somewhere else. This is sort of a born and raised and died town. And
right.
You have Polly who left and came back. So that's a bit of a different scenario, but she was still considered an out-of-towner when she made her return from San Francisco. And we learn more about that history along the way. And you know something is off with Leland Gaunt because he just has all of these items that everyone wants. And people are totally blinded by his ability to produce what they want at any given moment. You know, you walk by and you look in the window and you see something that you like and suddenly the store's open instead of closed. So right away, you know something weird is going on. And it felt a lot like Salem's Lot when you had those characters come in and set up an antique store and they're the outsiders. And you know something weird is going on because it's two guys who own the store, but you only ever see one of them in Salem's Lot. So this really felt like a callback to that, where you do see Leland Gaunt, but there's something that people just can't figure out about him. And they can't figure out how he has all of these things that they love so much that would be so expensive. And yet he just asks for basically whatever money they have and a favor. And the favors at first seem harmless. You know, Brian goes and throws mud on Wilma's sheets. It's like, okay, well, wash the sheets again. No big deal, really. And it just escalates everything and it builds up. And once you hit the end, you're like, oh, okay. You know, you start piecing together how all of these things affected one another. And you do that along the way too. But I think what Gaunt does so well is that he knows which strings to pull for which characters to make them feel like, oh, okay, well, this isn't so bad. I'm not really hurting anyone. But in the end, everyone gets hurt.
Right. And everyone's responsible because they chose to do this favor. And especially as the book continues and the favors ratchet up, like they start to know and feel bad. That's what, like Polly, like she knows by doing this task that she is contributing to something bad. And there's a couple people who realize right before they die, typically, that like, wait a second, no, this couldn't possibly be what's happening. And then, you know, they never actually get to say it, but we as the reader come to see how vital it was that each of these little pranks that's pulled will unravel this whole town's relationship. Every connection with some of them, their closest friends, are severed by these just little tasks that become bigger and bigger and bigger. And Gaunt is just so creepy, you know, even from the beginning, where you as the reader don't know that, you know, something's off, because obviously he's a bad guy because of how the book is set up.
Yeah.
But you have yet to learn just how awful and dangerous this guy is. And I think just the little touches that we get at the beginning, like how no one wants him to touch them.
Uh-huh.
Like, don't touch me. And his weird, creepy hands and his big, ugly teeth all also spiral into these bigger and bigger things that are off. And especially what we see with Ace, that's where we really start to see how off he is, because he doesn't care if Ace knows what's going on, because by then it's too late.
Right.
And he knows Ace is already in the bag for him. So it's lovely to watch how King unrolls the story and who exactly and what exactly Leland Gaunt is, kind of all at the same time.
Yeah, and I want to get your opinion on how great of a villain Leland Gaunt is in the King universe, because when I would think of the King villains, you know, Pennywise comes to mind, Randall Flagg comes to mind, Jack Torrance in The Shining comes to mind, you know, these characters that have become so iconic over the years. But I don't know if it's because the Needful Things movie adaptation wasn't nearly as popular as some of those novels or adaptations, but I just get this feeling that Leland Gaunt is possibly a top five King villain, if not definitely in the top 10, just because of how manipulative the character is. And even when he's asking for all these favors, he's still not even giving the people what they think they're getting. You know, the Sandy Koufax card that Brian thinks he's getting is really some random player who sucked. And Sean is kind of like, why are you carrying this random baseball card around? It's not even a good player.
Right?
Sort of thing. So Sean can see that, you know, this baseball card isn't what Brian thinks it is. And the sunglasses that Cora, their mom, has that are supposed to be Elvis's sunglasses or whatever, you know, they're really just a beat up, broken pair of sunglasses. So you get these moments where you truly see what these items are. And the characters have no idea because they're so blinded by sort of this spell that Gaunt has put them under. And, you know, eventually we figure out he's some sort of demon or something like that, and not just some random dude with abilities. He's disguised as a human and clearly not a very good one if people are kind of grossed out by him.
Right? I think Gaunt is definitely one of the more powerful, story-wise and impact-wise for the reader, villains out there. And I think he probably won't be known widely as that, because this is such a complicated book and it's so long that, I mean, if you could do a TV show, I would say if you could do like a 10-episode TV show or miniseries, that would be the way to tell this story. But a film, like 2 hours, no way. No way are you going to be able to get that across to people.
I am interested in the adaptation, though, just because of the casting and...
Yes, me too.
The fact that it seems like it has some things going for it, but I also have seen that it has generally more negative reviews, so that'll be interesting to see what elements they plucked out of the book, because this book, at least my copy, was over 700 pages, so that's a lot of book, and I think that's maybe my one complaint about it, is that we get so many characters that the book ends up being so long, and I would say it didn't really ramp up for me until probably when Ace showed up and you're like, oh boy, here we go.
Yes.
And it's one of those things where King obviously writes such long books to the point where I was excited that his next book was over 400 pages, which is still a relatively long book.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, so this much is short.
Yep. Yes, exactly. It's like, oh, it's not a brick. Great.
Yeah. And having read, I think Needful Things marked his 25th book that I've read, at least for this podcast. I think I've read a few after the fact. Well, actually, I know for a fact that I've read more than 25 of them, but I think it marks the 25th book that we've covered on this podcast, and this is actually episode 50. I should have mentioned that at the beginning of the show, but, you know, we're kind of hitting some good marks here with this book, and it's just been really interesting to see his writing and how it has changed and hit highs and lows just with this stretch of books, because this is the first book he wrote after his whole rehab situation and everything. So to have him just dive so deep into this novel and these characters, it was really impressive, but there was still something that was a little too long about it. And I couldn't quite place what it was, but I think it was something where I just felt like he took a while to get to the point. Even though you could kind of see things building up, I would have liked to see them build up a little faster, because then the end almost feels rushed because so much happens
all at once. It's all happening at the same time. And I totally agree. I was thinking you could have cut maybe 4 or 5 of these characters out, because I don't know that we really needed to see that part of it.
Yeah, like everything with Sally Radcliffe, I was like, okay, all right, yeah, I guess.
Her and her boyfriend, like, I guess that's how one of the deputies faces his end or whatever.
Yeah.
But I don't think we necessarily, like, you could have gone about it in a different way and cut a couple thousand words, because it definitely takes up, every single one of those characters takes up time. And while all of them contribute to the end, I don't know that we really needed that contribution. This book is so good at really leading us to the end of it. It isn't afraid to spread its wings out as far, but I don't know that it's necessarily needed, because at this point in his career, King is very, very good at setting up his story, and it feels like he goes overboard.
Uh-huh.
And also, you can really tell how much he missed the cocaine in this one. He talks about the coke so much and in such detail. I was like,
and of course, it has to do with Ace.
Yep, I was like, okay, honey, we know you loved the cocaine. We know how good it felt. We can tell.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
So I think the main issues I had were pacing wise, not necessarily story wise, but there were some curveballs, like when he throws in the child porn bit. I was like, whoa, 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 wait up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was like, what? I didn't need you to go this far. Or the story between the story between the best friends, and he goes and kills the parrot or whatever. Like,
and takes a dump on the picture of the guy's mom. And I was like,
yeah,
this got very weird very quickly. And it didn't really feel like it had much to do with a whole lot in the town. You were kind of just like, okay, that was a very weird tangent. Can we get back to the characters we actually find interesting and enjoy?
Right. Right. That's, and there's a few of those. And I, and that's what drags down the pacing, because you kind of stop, especially at the end, where everything is going and we are ready to see how everything's going to implode. And then we stop and take these digressions, and it just feels like you're hitting a rut. And okay, now we got to get back on the road. And it becomes, especially, like I said, as we're coming to the end of the book, it's frustrating, because I would say there's probably, my copy was almost 700 pages. I think it was 680. And I would say the first 500 are all set up. And that is a lot of setup.
The thing is, though, at least with the story, it's so character driven that you don't mind that there isn't really a whole lot of plot in the background. Really, the story and the plot are, you have this new shop owner who comes to town, and he can basically make whatever someone wants appear, and all they have to do is give him a little money and owe him a favor.
Yep.
That's a pretty simple storyline, but because of the character work and how these characters act, how they react to one another, that's really what drives the story forward and makes all of this chaos so believable. Because at first, you don't really know that Gaunt is a demon or anything. He kind of has this creepy old man vibe initially. And that's kind of what I saw him as, because I was like, okay, creepy old dude comes to town and maybe he has some magical powers, which kind of the case, kind of not the case. But I didn't think of him as a demon or Satan himself or anything like that. So when you hit that at the end, you're like, oh, okay, well, you know, that makes sense. And he kind of can't be killed. He can't be stopped. And he's always so reluctant to meet Alan that you're kind of like, okay, well, clearly Alan is going to see right through everything. And that has a lot to do with because of what he saw with the dark half, I feel like. So Gaunt knew probably what Alan had seen with the dark half. He had this knowledge about everyone that you're kind of like, okay, that's really creepy, but I guess some of that could just be sort of public knowledge, you know. Maybe he sort of looked up everyone in town before he came, so he knew a little bit about them. And it isn't really until he digs up Polly's past where you're like, all right, you went a little too far. It's not just that you knew Brian's brother's name or something like that, something simple. It was something much more complex, and the story was a simple one, but it's the complexity of the characters that made the story so much more interesting than the premise of it.
And I love that Leland Gaunt, you really, from the beginning of the book, it feels like he knows stuff, and then it begins to feel like he knows everything. But then once you really get into it with Polly and Alan and some of the bigger characters who are more capable of recognizing what's really going on and aren't swept up in these delusions that he's in, these dreams that he's handing out, where you see him making mistakes. And that part of it is the more fascinating part, because it's like, oh, well, he's not infallible. He makes mistakes, like how, you know, Alan's wife is wearing her seatbelt in the dream vision he gives Alan, or how he gets Polly's last name wrong on the letter he sends. Like those little bits of it. And you wonder, okay, does he not know everything, or is he just getting too overeager and isn't being careful about what he's giving these people? Or is it that these are the more, giving someone a baseball card that they want, like, you don't need to know all of these deep details about their life, just that this kid likes baseball cards. Well, what's his favorite baseball card he doesn't have? You know, whereas getting into the nitty gritty of Alan's pain or Polly's pain and these deep emotional issues that they have, mm-hmm. those are so much more complicated, and it doesn't feel like Gaunt is quite that capable, which really makes him better as a villain. And I feel like Gaunt is very much inspired by C.S. Lewis's the Screwtape Letters, okay. which is all about a demon who is collecting souls. And the whole story is, it's him writing back to Satan. The main character is a demon who is going around and tempting people to collect their souls. And he has a like an amount that he has to get. That's his job. And so the letters are him telling how he's seduced all these people into giving him their souls. And that's very much what this feels like at the end. Because, you know, Gaunt is going to take his bag of souls away. And King really captures that demon aspect of it at the end. Even though it kind of comes out of nowhere, it's very believable from what he's set up about Gaunt since the beginning.
I think with Gaunt, he could easily find out facts about people. But when it came to emotions, he could manipulate them into feeling certain emotions towards someone. But when it came to emotions that they felt towards themselves, like with Polly and with Alan, he struggled a lot more. He couldn't overcome this variable because emotions aren't always predictable, whereas it's very predictable that Brian wanted a Sandy Koufax card.
Right.
You know, like you said, that's a fact. He had a baseball card collection. That's a card he didn't have. That's pretty black and white. But Alan and Polly were both struggling with these past tragic events that happened to them to the point where they would confront each other, or at least Polly would confront Alan about his, because he didn't have any knowledge of hers, really. Polly had never gone into details with him. So when she was noticing these things, initially she was reasonably upset to think that Alan went behind her back and did this. But as she sort of worked through it in her mind, the emotions kind of dropped and she was able to think about it rationally. And she was like, okay, well, you know, Alan really wouldn't have done this. So Gaunt was relying on being able to manipulate their emotions, but he didn't think about the fact that there would be rationality with anyone, because as we saw, Wilma was very irrational. There was nothing rational about that character at all. So no. A character like Wilma, sure, she's going to fly off the handle. And with Polly, she did that initially, but not in a way that was hurtful. Obviously, Alan was hurt by it, but not to the point where he couldn't do his job or just kind of carry on, because he knew that rationally he had to do this. He was like, okay, I'll deal with Polly later, but there's so much going on. I can't let those emotions get to me. And he didn't depend on that rationality, because you see him preying on people who aren't necessarily rational, or they're too young to know better, really. And even Brian knows better by the end of it.
Yeah, the end for him is so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
So hard. And then, yeah, that was bad. And I think that really shows, King unfolds that, well, in the beginning, it seems like Gaunt really understands people. It becomes obvious by the end that he really doesn't, that he thinks he understands how people work, but his understanding is very surface level, and like he looks down on people.
Uh-huh.
He thinks of them as simple creatures, which betrays his lack of understanding of how the human mind works, and that is what gets him in the end. That is where, and it's like he has this sense that there are certain people he shouldn't mess with, like trying to keep Alan out of things as much as possible.
Uh-huh.
And his really delicate interactions with Polly, because he knows that if he rushes into it with Polly, it's not going to work, because she doesn't have this big thing she wants. Mm-hmm. She's made her life for herself. The thing where she is weak is in her crippling guilt and anxiety and pain over the death of her child. And that, like we said, is a lot more complicated than a baseball card. So that unfolding, I think, is the most terrifying and reassuring part about Gaunt as a villain, because you see his weakness in that he underestimates, and that the way to defeat him is to hold rationality and truth in your heart and think about how you know people. Because Polly and Alan both succeed because they know that the other one loves them and wouldn't do these ridiculous things to hurt them. So that works out so well in the end.
Plus, by the time we get to the end of the novel, you can tell that Gaunt had this all worked out from the beginning. Obviously, hindsight is 20/20 when you finish a novel and you're like, oh, okay, now I see how all of that came together. But as soon as Gaunt got to town and opened his shop, he knew exactly what he was doing, and he was so egomaniacal that he thought everything would go off without a hitch. And when you throw in someone like Alan, who is very rational but is also able to understand these irrational things that happen in a way that maybe not everyone else in town can, just because of his past experience again with what happened in the Dark Half, you kind of think, okay, well, obviously Gaunt is right to not want Alan to come into the store, but at the same time, he can't rationally think that Alan isn't going to be curious. Like, oh, this new guy came to town and all of a sudden the town is in complete shambles. And he's going to make that connection. Gaunt just doesn't get out in time. And you have that final confrontation between them. And it's just done so well, because Gaunt thought he could outsmart everyone and that by keeping Alan at a distance, he would succeed. But I don't think he expected Polly to throw a wrench in his plans in the way that she did, because really she's the only one who is able to fight off what has happened. And we mentioned that sad ending with Brian, but Gaunt's role really was to throw this town into chaos, get away with it, and move on to the next town. And he still does move on to the next town. So there actually kind of is a little epilogue here. And when right. I read that, I was like, okay, I see what you're doing, King. I see it. I kind of like it. Because it wasn't a direct epilogue to what happened in Castle Rock. It was an epilogue for Gaunt, not for the town. So I think that worked a little better as an epilogue. And it was only not even 2 pages, I don't think.
Yeah. It was very short, but just enough to tell you that, oh God, another...
Here we go again.
Yes, very much here we go again.
And I think that sort of here we go again worked a little better than it did in a novel like Christine.
Yes.
Because I felt like Christine had such a good ending before the epilogue that we didn't really need that epilogue. But this, there was some ambiguity. You're like, okay, well, he's just gonna go. You know, you can't kill him, so... on to the next, I guess.
Right. And I think it's because this book is so long, it feels like it takes forever. But really, this all unfolds within 2 weeks. And
it's crazy 2 weeks.
Yeah. And when you think about it and you think how this demon has been going from town to town to town, and it makes the case that he's been doing this since, you know, before the plague years. So for 2,000 years or something, or 1,000 years, whatever, he's been doing this over the course of 2 weeks. Imagine how many towns he's able to do this to. And granted, they're probably all very small, because doing something like this in New York is definitely not going to work, because no. there's too many Alan Pangborns and Polly Chalmers for that to take hold. He really has to go within these places where there's already all of these fault lines between relationships, because these people have been living their whole lives with all these other people. And when you do that, you get, you know, they're all forced together into this situation. And so everyone just kind of puts up with their frustrations and issues. And it makes for some very tenuous relationships between people that can easily be exploited, which, like, again, in New York, you know, you've got millions of people. So those relationships are very spread out. So it becomes even more upsetting, because you know this guy has been manipulating people for so long that it seems impossible that anyone could really stop him. Like, Alan is able to make him leave, but he is not able to, like, hurt him or kill him or in any way affect Gaunt's future. He just prevents Gaunt from taking the souls of the people in the town so he can have some kind of healing for those people. Because I was wondering, like, okay, well, are all these people going to die because their souls are? But thankfully, the souls all go back to their people, and like there's a sensation of wholeness that comes back to them, and they see the insanity that's been happening and that they've been perpetrating, and they're like, ooh, better stop doing this now.
Also that sense of what just happened.
right, because definitely by the end Gaunt is putting these people under a spell. He just kind of nips in through the cracks in their morals and in their sense of reality and twists their want to take over their whole personage.
Yeah, so I want to do something a little different here and speculate a little about what the state of Castle Rock might have been like after this, because I mentioned earlier in the episode that we do see Castle Rock again, so this isn't totally the last Castle Rock story. We get a little bit of an epilogue in Nightmares and Dreamscapes. I think a couple years after this, that was released in 93, and then Elevation, which came out in 2018, much more recent, visits Castle Rock again. And as far as I can remember, I don't think there's any real direct ties to Needful Things in that novella, but it's very interesting that Stephen King considered this the last Castle Rock story, even though we now know that not to be true. So what do you think the state of Castle Rock was like after this? Because you have all of these characters who, with the exception of Polly, were born and raised here from what we can tell. And there's been so much death in this 2-week period that you can imagine it had to have had a lasting impact on this town, but the town didn't completely vanish in the way that it does in Carrie, where, you know, Carrie does so much damage to that town in particular, it just becomes deserted. And we know for a fact that doesn't happen with Castle Rock, but I'm just curious what you think sort of the state of mind of everyone in Castle Rock would have been like after this. Do you think they had sort of this period of complete shock and mourning, and then they sort of had to start all over again? Or do you think they were probably like, okay, what just happened? That was crazy, but we have to move on with our lives. And things just went back to normal.
I think it's probably a mix. I think there, fortunately, were probably more than a few suicides afterwards, because near the end, you start to see the people who, like Sally Radcliffe, who realizes that she's manipulated and was wrong and should have trusted her boyfriend. You know, she kills herself. So does Brian. And I think the guilt, especially for those who like Reverend Rose and some of the other people who are involved in the church, like they perpetrated some pretty terrible things. And so all the people who went out and pulled those pranks, I think there was certainly a risk that they would feel so much guilt that they wouldn't be able to live with it. And then I think there are probably those people who just pick up and move on and keep going. And then I think there are people who probably just left because of the stress, and the people who weren't affected, you know, those who just didn't, who just went about their lives not being involved in any way with Gaunt or the rest of the town generally, probably like, whoa, I don't know what just happened here, but I need to get the hell out.
Which is kind of Alan's reaction. You know, he's like, I'm done. Yeah. Not sheriff.
Polly, we're leaving.
Yeah.
I'm not doing this anymore. And I think, like, it's not like in Tommyknockers where the entire town is sucked into this. King mentions that one of the women who dies had never bought anything from Leland Gaunt and hadn't been touched by this at all, but she dies because of a freak accident. You know, so obviously there were people who weren't involved in this, and I would imagine a certain section of them would be like, this is too crazy, I'm out. Because why would you stay in a town where apparently the two religious communities of the church can get into a horrific brawl and start killing each other? over seemingly nothing. You know, a casino night is not a reason to riot. No rumbling for that, please.
Yeah, that would be a bit excessive, but because all of the emotions are heightened by everything that's been happening,
right,
you can tell that everyone is just taking these things to such an extreme that they normally wouldn't, even though, you know, the Reverend is upset and Buster is upset because, you know, he's embezzling money, he has a gambling problem, and Gaunt basically promises to fix everything. And he really doesn't by the end of it either. You know, he gives all of this false hope to all of these people, and the town is almost literally crushed by it. You have explosions going off everywhere, and it's just complete madness. So I think it is reasonable that some people would be like, okay, this is over, this is done with, let's move on. But others would be like, wow, what just happened? This is crazy. And you have a family like the Rusk family who really, really suffers. And Sean is probably the one who might be the most impacted by this because of how impressionable he is at such a young age. And he's really a character you feel bad for. Some of them you don't feel bad for. Like, you do not feel bad for Wilma at all.
No.
You don't feel bad for Keaton. You don't feel bad for Ace. And these characters who were so unlikable even before any of this happened, you're just like, all right, well, you guys kind of got what you deserved. No offense, but, you know, this is what you get for acting this way before Gaunt even came to town. So you have those characters, and it's reasonable that some of the characters who survive would be more impacted by it than others. You know, Wilma's husband was probably like, yes, freedom.
Yeah. Yes. I got that sense too, that he was like, I don't know what I got myself into here. I'm just trying to survive.
Yeah.
And that's before, like, all of the shit starts to go crazy with between Wilma and Nettie. That's just the beginning. He's already...
He was drugging her just to get her to calm down and not, like, go and kill someone.
Yeah, with the help of a doctor who's like, yeah, I'm just going to pass you these pills.
Here you go, buddy. Good luck.
Right? It's like, now he's been freed from this, because he also doesn't buy anything from Gaunt's shop and is really hit sideways with everything that's happened. And it's very interesting that he doesn't necessarily seem surprised by the ending. You know, he just gives all the information to the cops. He's like, yeah, she was pretty crazy. I was drugging her when she got too crazy. And but it he you really get the sense that he knows how far Wilma is willing to go, which sells the idea that Wilma didn't need a whole lot of persuasion for this to happen. She just needed an opportunity.
It's even better that the cops don't really care that he was drugging his wife.
Yeah, they're like, reasonable, because they list out how many calls she'd had on her, and it was a lot.
Yes.
Because she, with people who she was feuding with and people who said that they were scared of her and that she'd had restraining orders taken out against her, like, that's pretty extreme. Obviously, this guy knew his wife was unhinged, and he was just trying to manage it as best he could.
And then when they pull the calls for Nettie, it's just Wilma. She's the only one complaining about Nettie. And
yes, you
know, Nettie has literally killed someone before. And people don't have any complaints about her except for Wilma. So that goes to show you what the state of mind was like for Wilma. She just was like a dog with a bone. No pun intended, because she hated that dog so much. And, you know, arguably Brian and the dog get the saddest endings out of everyone.
Yes.
Obviously, you have some other characters who either get severely beat up or die that you really feel bad for. But I think because of the innocence of both Brian and the dog, you're like, oh, man, that is just so heartbreaking. But, you know, there's so much to the story. I feel like it's so hard to cover everything. But do you have any final thoughts, anything else that you think we should hit on that maybe we didn't yet?
I do want to say that I think this is one of King's, despite how long it is and how much setup versus payoff, I think it is really worth reading because of how it unspools and how well these characters are written and how interesting it all becomes, because there's so much psychology between people in this one, as much as there's character development, we also see a lot about how people interact with each other, and it feels very realistic. And that part, I think, is one of the strongest aspects of the book. And the ending. I wanted to talk about the ending. So if you haven't read it and you want to, maybe skip forward 30 seconds or so.
Yeah.
Like, do you think, because we've talked before about how there are people who don't really like King books because they don't think the endings work. As someone, I haven't read The Dark Half. Is the ending more sensible with Alan all of a sudden being like, I have big magic powers? Does that make sense because of his experiences in The Dark Half?
I think it's one of those things where Alan has been so impacted by these sort of supernatural events that have happened in both The Dark Half and in Needful Things, to where it's a little weird because Alan is sort of just this normal guy, but in a way that makes sense for how that character connects to the Hulu show.
Okay.
Because one, the Hulu show is a lot to take in. You know, I might have to go back and rewatch it at some point just because I felt like I was getting some of the references while watching it, but unless you've really taken in the Stephen King universe as a whole, I feel like you might not catch on to everything. And I think Alan was one of those characters I didn't really truly understand in the series until going back and reading both The Dark Half and this. So I think for that ending in Needful Things to make sense, you kind of have to take in everything and be like, okay, well, here's Alan's progression. We see him in The Dark Half. This is what happens to him. Then this crazy thing happens in Needful Things. And then when you go from that to the Hulu series, you kind of see the connection being made. And even though it's a little abrupt, I would say, not a little, it's a lot abrupt at the end of this, it's something to where if you have all of that context, you're like, okay, I kind of understand why he did this. I don't know if he needed to do it, but you can understand that.
Okay, that was what I was thinking, is like, okay, I feel like maybe I just don't have the full picture of this character. Because typically, when King has his protagonists face a great evil, like they are with Leland Gaunt, he also sets up what kind of good they're tapping into. You know, like in It, you know, you have the turtle and what is beyond the turtle that gives these children the ability to fight against it. And in this, there's just no setup for that. Like, all of a sudden, Alan is just able to do crazy good magic. And I felt like, for someone who doesn't, who reads, you know, who's read five or six King books and doesn't necessarily, isn't really willing to buy into how King does his endings, I feel like this probably would not have been very satisfying, because it feels like it comes out of nowhere. And I was willing to roll with it, because I'm happy with how King ends his books typically. But it did feel a bit, like you said, abrupt.
Yeah.
So, but I still like that Alan is able to be the person who stops it. Because it feels like he deserves that after everything he goes through in this book, and after all of the pain that you read about with his wife and son. And it feels like this guy should get the chance to defend his town, because he obviously cares about Castle Rock so much.
Yeah, and I think that's one of those things that made this book so enjoyable. You had these characters you could hate, these characters you could really care about, and at the center of it all was Alan, who was the peacekeeper, quite literally. And
you're right.
You have him trying to balance all of these things that are happening, and with a department as small as I imagine Castle Rock's is for the sheriff's department, you're like, okay, this guy is way in over his head at this very moment in time, but he's handling it as well as could be expected. And so when he's given that ability at the end, you feel like he's at least earned it.
Yeah.
With everything that he's gone through. And, you know, aside from the pacing issues, I really enjoyed this book. I ended up giving it a 4.5 out of 5, because I was like, okay, if he had just toned it down a little bit, taken a little bit out, you know, the whole child porn and dumping on the mother's picture scenario. Like, there were a few things where I was like, okay, I see what your commentary is about these things, but at the same time, it distracted a little, but not so much to the point where I was like, oh, well, that just ruined the whole thing for me. So 4.5 out of 5 for me. This is one of his top tier books that I've read so far. As I mentioned, I've probably read about 30 books. Like I said, this is the 25th one roughly that we've covered for the podcast, but I have read some of the later books. And I just really feel like character work is where King stands out. So having a ton of characters isn't really a negative. It can be for some books. You're like, wait, who's who? But in this, yes, you knew who everyone was. You're like, okay, Wilma's this person, Nettie's this person, Polly is this person, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I would say I would give this a 4 out of 5 because I agree. This is one of his best character work books, and it's so interesting. Like, as much as the setup is, like I said, a bit too long, it is so fascinating what each person wants and why, because he does go into that for, I think, pretty much everyone who actually buys something from Needful Things that we see in the book. Mm-hmm. And I think that really works. And it was the thing that I was the most interested in is how, and then how he turns them all against each other, like twisting a knob. Just, oh, let's turn you to crazy and now you to crazy. And that all works so well. And I cannot imagine what the plotting process was like for this book. Because typically King talks about how he doesn't know the end. He just gets an idea and he just starts writing.
Yeah.
But for something like this, I can't imagine that he did it quite as seat of the pants.
Yeah.
Because there's so much going on. I imagine kind of like an evidence dungeon room, you know, where he's got a wall filled with post-its and tacks put in and red string all over. And
I've kind of always wanted a room like that.
I know. Me too. Me too. You could do it with Stephen King's The Connections of the World.
Yeah.
Because there is pretty big. But that's kind of what I felt like. And I think that was, for me, the most rewarding part of the book is seeing how he sets up all of these connections and then how he almost like tugs one string and then everything comes tumbling down.
Exactly. Well, Katie, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this one. I knew it was going to be a slightly lengthier discussion than some of the ones we've been having lately, especially, you know, our Golden Years episode. And we have a couple more books that we're going to hit by the end of the year, and you happen to be coming back for both of them. So I am definitely looking forward to seeing what else King does with the remaining characters that we're going to be discussing this year. But, you know, episode 50, I feel like this is a pretty big milestone. It's not episode 100, not yet. We're halfway there, though. And trust me, there are many more episodes to come. And before we go, I just want to quickly let you all know about our Patreon. You can support the podcast for $1 a month or $2 a month. You will get a thank you on the show for the $1 a month tier. You'll get a Chat Cemetery sticker for the $2 a month tier. And you can find us at Chat Cemetery on Twitter and Instagram. Katie, again, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this one.
And thank you for having me. This was a really good discussion, and I hope everyone enjoyed it.
Same here. And as always, to our listeners, thank you all for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.